Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Rob Walker has seen emergency preparedness from both sides now. In 1999, he and his girlfriend moved out of New York to live somewhere less expensive, less sophisticated, less intense. They chose New Orleans. Now, Rob Walker's new book is out, a collection of letters he wrote friends and family about seeing New Orleans through a newbie's eyes before the flood. Also out is the latest edition of Walker's New York Times Magazine column. You know, he writes that consumed column. Did you see it yesterday? It's about the Museum of Modern Art exhibition of products designed for emergencies. Neither the column nor the book refer to each other, but somehow they relate. Letters from New Orleans is published by the Garrett County Press. We welcome Rob Walker back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let's begin with the magazine column. And though you don't mention us by name, there's a WNYC reference in the piece. The guy who listens to public radio broadcasts on his stoop after the New York City blackout of 2003. Why'd you write about him?
Well, he was he's a sort of an architect and an expert on issues around preparing for design around catastrophe and major issues like that. And he was talking about something in an interview about a product called the FreePlay radio, which is used which was sort of invented to help spread news, to help combat AIDS in Africa, this third world situation, very sort of dire situation. And then he mentions in the interview that he also had one, and that he used it on his stoop to listen to NPR during the last blackout. And I thought that was an interesting coming together of product linking two very different kinds of scenarios.
And what exactly is a free play radio?
Free play radio is the kind that is either powered by solar power or by a hand crank, so that you can use it in all kinds of situations where you don't have a plug, either
or a battery.
Or a battery, and you can use it in a situation like the desperate conditions in Africa or, when the lights are out in New York.
Right. And this free play radio is not just at Radio Shack, but in the Museum of Modern Art, is the point?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they have a show up right there, the design show called Safe, which is all about, it's a huge variety of products dealing with different kinds of risk. Everything from products like that and very serious things to sort of silly things like this one called the banana bunker, which you use to protect your banana in a bag.
A banana bunker. Yeah. You mean, this is a good idea. It's like a hard plastic case.
Exactly.
So the bananas don't get squashed under the cantaloupes.
You're interested, yeah.
I don't see it as an emergency preparedness thing quite, though.
It keeps your banana safe.
Yes,
safe.
Yes. Actually, I like how you could read the title, the name of the MoMA exhibit two ways. It's either called Safe, Design Takes on Risk, or Safe, Design Takes on Risk.
Yeah, exactly.
What else is there?
Just a variety of things from sort of emergency shelter type units that are used in disasters, and then on down to things that are kind of almost ironic. There are some handbags that have an outline of a knife on the side, so it looks as though you have it's sort of a humorous thing. So it's a wide-ranging take on the subject.
And you're right that whether most consumers who buy things like the FreePlay radio ever use them is beside the point. Preparedness and paranoia are equally valid sources to tap. Why'd you put it that way? I'll bet many of us have spent considerable time in the last 4 years trying to figure out where our own preparedness ends and our paranoia begins.
Sure, sure. Well, the other reason that I was so interested in that FreePlay radio is when I read that guy's anecdote, having lived in New Orleans, and I wasn't there during the storm, but obviously had a lot of friends who were, and have put a lot more thought into disaster preparedness as an individual than I would have a year ago. And that's exactly the question that I was thinking about myself, is that am I being really rational and planning ahead, or am I just being another paranoid fool?
Which brings us to the Tell Us About Yourself, Rob, part of the interview. And my guest is Rob Walker, who you may read as the Consumed columnist in the New York Times Magazine. He also has a new book called Letters from New Orleans. What made you decide to move to New York, from New York to New Orleans, a city you'd only spent really a handful of days in before you took the plunge?
Yeah, well, in some ways that's the question that I spend the entire book trying to come to an answer to. There's not a good answer to it. We were, as you said in your introduction, some of the basic reasons are looking for a cheaper place to live, looking for a different lifestyle, just looking for a change. I'd been in New York for
people
a while.
People living in Brooklyn looking for a cheaper place to live moved to Hoboken, the French Quarter.
Well, it's funny you would say that. We were living in Greenwich Village, and we started looking for a cheaper apartment, and we looked in Brooklyn, we looked in Hoboken, and the apartments were still so expensive. We said, look, if you have to move to the outer reaches of Brooklyn, you may as well just go ahead and go for it.
And so you and your girlfriend moved in 1999, and the book is a collection of letters that you wrote to friends and family and others on your email list between 2000 and 2003. Is this now of interest to publish because of Hurricane Katrina?
Well, it came out, it's been an interesting ride with this book because it came out just before the storm. And I spent a month or so having very mixed feelings about the book even existing because it was written with a very different intention in mind than putting New Orleans in some sort of perspective. A lot more people started thinking about New Orleans in August 29th than had been thinking about it before that. It kind of changed the whole meaning of the book. The book was not intended to be sort of here is a snapshot of a place as it was at a certain point in time. But that is ultimately what the book now is, and I guess I've sort of learned to live with that.
We can take phone calls, by the way, for Rob Walker on any of his consumed columns or anything else that he writes about or anything that we'll talk about regarding his book, Letters from New Orleans, at 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. And by the way, I'll be doing, some of you may be interested, a visual take on the MoMA Safe exhibit on television Wednesday night. I'll be interviewing the curator of SAFE, Paola Antonelli, on CUNY TV Wednesday night at 7:30. That's channel 75 on the New York City cable systems. And we'll have slides of probably the Free Play Radio and some other things from that exhibit that you can see on TV. You did in the book, reading these old letters right from day one in early 2000, acknowledge the legitimate possibility of being wiped out someday by a flood. So I guess, did New Orleanians live with that in the background, like Californians live with earthquakes?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's funny when you read that sentence now, it's on like the second page of the book, and it really pops out in a way that it didn't before, because it was kind of, it's definitely part of life there. It's part of life there the same way that, walking into this building just now, I had to go through all the metal detectors and stuff. And, a lot of us live with risk all the time in a lot of places. And you are cognizant of the possibility of something happening. And at the same time, you kind of just don't think it's ever going to happen. Because if you really did think it was going to happen, I don't know how you could get through your day. You would be sort of paralyzed. But it was definitely part of life in the sense that people joked about it. I was living there when the Times-Picayune came out with that enormous series that got attention so belatedly about, they really chased down every single possible nightmare scenario.
Right, and how messed up the levees were, right?
And every aspect of all the problems that existed and the wetland problem and every aspect of it. It's something people talked about. It's something that people had learned to live with.
And you just moved there because you wanted to drink beer and eat crawfish.
Sort of. Well, I actually grew up on another part of the Gulf Coast. So the hurricane thing was not a huge scare tactic. The thing that's different about New Orleans, of course, is the below sea level thing. And the difficulty, one of the things people don't talk about as much is it's a difficult place to get out of when a hurricane is coming. You're really supposed to leave 72 hours beforehand, and no one really knows where a hurricane is going to hit.
Right.
72 hours.
Right.
Beforehand.
So how do you convince people to leave
their
homes?
So it's very difficult. Yeah. By the time you really know it's coming, it's kind of too late.
Preventive or preemptive evacuation.
Yeah, that or a lot of Free Play Radios.
So where did you grow up?
Outside of Houston.
Outside of Houston. So this was the second time you had moved halfway across the country, as you put it, to change your life, right?
Yeah.
You came to New York. Because?
Came to New York for all the reasons that, the 22-year-old or whatever comes to New York back then, just trying to get better jobs and that kind of thing.
And you lived in New York for 8 years.
Yeah.
And you came to see your move to New Orleans and a lot of New Orleanians' lives, as you write, as an act of constructing your own persona.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the interesting things about New Orleans, obviously a big part of New Orleans culture is is Mardi Gras and Carnival and all that. And it was a real learning experience for me to see how that is different to as a part of the city than it is seeing it on the you know, once a year evening news shot of Bourbon Street. But, you know, the mask, the idea of the mask is very built into the culture of New Orleans, and I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and the idea that in some ways the mask on Mardi Gras Day sets you free and lets you be this person that you wouldn't be in your day-to-day life. And then if you really think about it, well, is that the real you, or is the person in your day-to-day life the real you? It's interesting stuff to consider, right?
Right. And yet it's the same reason that people move to New York, to reinvent themselves.
It's absolutely the same reason that people make moves across the country and, you know, to get a new job, to have a new identity, be a place where you can sort of present a new version of yourself to people who don't know any better.
So who is the new persona for you? How is the Rob Walker who lived in New Orleans different from the one who lived in New York?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, a lot of it was thinking about those issues. I think that you confront that kind of stuff in a different way when you're living in a place that says they couldn't be two more different cities. And it was a fascinating contrast to go from one to the other. New York being a very ambitious place, very much built around what you do for a living and how you're doing at that. New Orleans, a place where you go to party and literally the whole evening, no one asks you what you do for a living. They just ask you, you know, can I get you another beer?
Rob Walker, my guest on WNYC. You may know him best from the Consumed column, which he writes in the New York Times Magazine. He also has a new book called Letters from New Orleans about his first 3 years or so living there, 1999 to 2003. Rob, by the way, will be reading with Ken Wells and Roy Blunt Jr. on Thursday, December 8th at the Little Red Schoolhouse, 40 Charlton Street between 6th and 7th Avenues in Greenwich Village. That's going to be $20 at the door, or you can call 212-477-5316. And part of the funds will go toward purchasing books for K-12 schools in Baton Rouge. 212-433-WNYC, our phone number if you want to talk to Rob Walker. And Cole and Watchung, you're on WNYC. Hello.
How are you all today?
How you doing?
Hi.
Great. Good show, both ends. The question I have could either go to each segment of the show, but the one that's been brought up now is great. It's been bugging me since I'm a civics teacher how the concept of civil defense has sort of fallen by the wayside, and now we have almost a professional delegation away from citizens about the knowledge and the processes of what a citizen does in an emergency. Now, I'm not talking about excusing the duck and cover, get under a school desk in the 1950s, which didn't make much sense, but I mean a more basic citizen's guidebook is, here's an emergency, here's what we do, here's where we go. Now it seems as though the government has us consume disaster relief as a service, and we just wait around for the government to decide what to do, if in fact they do. I guess my question is, it seems as though citizens have disconnected to get another level from the life that they're supposed to lead in a free society.
Yeah, Rob, there's something for the Consumed column. We consume disaster relief services.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a commodity.
It's definitely...
Well, it used to be we would take... That people sort of knew, in an informal or informal way, they had a sense as, we're in it together, let's work together until the government catches up with us, or just a literally civil
right.
defense.
Well, Cole, how about if you see something, say something?
Well, that could be. I mean, but it seems as though folks now, as opposed to before, we wait for the other specialists. I mean, it galled me when they chose the name Homeland Security. Where does that come from? How about civil defense? It's been around. It'll be around.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly fascinating to look at in the wake of Katrina. Where would we be without organizations like Red Cross and so on that are not, you know, formally part of the government in any way? And I know that when they were, or at least my understanding is that at the last minute when they were trying to do the evacuation of New Orleans, they were relying a lot on church groups. That was what the city government was doing, was reaching out to church groups to try to get them to be that last mile of communication or whatever to the actual citizenry of the Ninth Ward and other parts of the city.
And, you know, we live in a country that doesn't believe anybody and that doesn't trust our institutions.
Yep.
And, frankly, probably the old civil defense. You know, how many baby boomers have you spoken to who did grow up getting under their desks
yeah.
and grew up to think it was absurd and another example of government incompetence or
yeah.
propaganda?
Yeah. And I mean,
you know,
you see
and now nobody believes the government when they tell you to have a go bag and have duct tape ready or
right.
whatever it is. People
right.
laugh or mock.
Right. Or the multicolor threat defense system being
exactly.
raised and lowered or whatever. It's not something that I would say has been taken terribly seriously by most of the population.
So where were you when Hurricane Katrina hit?
Oddly enough, I was on an airplane to Las Vegas. where I was going to a trade show, a fashion industry trade show, for reasons having to do with the consumed column. And I was in contact with E from the book, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife. I was in contact with her, you know, whenever I could. And when I first landed, it sounded like, things aren't so bad. Like we dodged, you know, the thing you hear that it sounds like they dodged the bullet.
The first morning, I'll never forget that Monday morning, we did the show, and that's what we were talking about because we were right in that little window in this 10 a.m. to noon time on that Monday.
Yeah.
Oh, it looks like they dodged a bullet, not so bad.
Right. And then by the end of the day, the end of my day in Las Vegas, when I spoke to her again, it was very clear that things were coming unraveled, that the water was rising, and so on. And it was, I can't think of a more strange place to be sort of, you know, stuck than a Las Vegas fashion convention and trying to think about your friends. There were people I couldn't get a hold of. My best friend down there I know had ridden it out and he did prove to be okay, but I couldn't get hold of him for several days. And, you know,
and what became of your home?
Actually, I was just down there, and the home is the house that we lived in is basically okay. And I talked to the people who are living there now.
Are you going back there to live?
You know, it sounds kind of crazy, but we do talk about it. We do talk about it. We have both just been down there separately in the last couple of weeks to catch up with people, to look around. It's very emotional to go down there. There are a lot of positive signs and a lot of pessimistic signs, but it does kind of make you want to be a part of whatever's going to happen next, because I think there's just no way of knowing.
Yeah, you've moved across the country twice to change your life. You know, Helena, Montana is a nice place.
A little cold, I think.
It is interesting to see you writing years before the flood about the same problems that the rest of America became aware of afterwards, and we all know what they are now. But you wrote about the election of Mayor Ray Nagin at the time that it happened, and now Nagin is a symbol of the state versus local blame game, you know, versus federal blame game, and trying to put a city back together. And back then, as you inform us, he was a cable TV executive trying to become mayor, ethically suspect in some ways, victim of a racist campaign against him in other ways. We just have about 30 seconds, but who was Ray Nagin to you before Katrina, and who is he now?
Well, I think in the context of New Orleans politics, pretty good is my take on him both before and after. I think that he, you know, I think he came in as a reform guy trying to run the city like a business. That's an unlikely scenario, New Orleans, to be run that way. But I think it was probably the right thing at the right time. I think few politicians are prepared for a scenario like that, and particularly in that kind of city. So he's got a tough road ahead of him.
Rob Walker's book is called Letters from New Orleans. It's published by the Garrett County Press. Again, he'll be doing a reading with Ken Wells and Roy Blunt Jr. on Thursday, December 8th at the Little Red Schoolhouse, 40 Charlton Street. They are charging $20 for that at the door, but part of the money will go toward purchasing books for elementary schools in Baton Rouge. Always love reading your column. And it's a good book, and thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.